Okay, let's jump in where we left off. So we ended with Adam and Eve's eviction from the garden. Obviously, life on earth would be very different for humanity than it would have been in the garden. And Scripture is almost completely silent about the events that transpire over the next 1,500 years or so. Moses essentially pushes fast forward, and we fly through the centuries up to the flood. The lifespan of the patriarchs from Adam to Noah are given there in Genesis 5. Those Bible believers who believe in an old age of the earth, as promoted by modern uniformitarian geology, sometimes will try to add gaps into these genealogies to accommodate an old earth. In response to that, besides the fact that dating techniques are based on uniformitarianism, which is easily shown to be a terrible assumption in geology, and besides the fact that squeezing time in when humans are really already on the scene is not really helping with geology, let me talk about that for a moment. When you look at the geologic column, the layers of rocks that are beneath us and above us in certain places, humans don't show up in the geologic column until the very top. So any time you squeeze in when humans are already around is not explaining the geologic column. The bulk of the column is stuff before humans even show up in the fossil record. So essentially, time has to be squeezed into Genesis 1 if you're going to squeeze it anywhere, and yet we can nail down the fact that can't happen. It's either or. Either the Bible's right or it's not. The Bible does not endorse this idea. And I can show you mounds of evidence from science that shows you that it's not necessary to even do that, to try to squeeze in time. But the way that Moses then states these genealogies also really leaves no room for these kind of gaps anyway, even if it could help. Over and over throughout the chapter, he uses this formula: X lived A years and had Y, and then X lived B years, and the total lifespan was X of X was A plus B. So with this formula, Moses nails down the chronology tightly and allows no gaps in this pre-flood period. Genesis 5 provides one of the primary biblical evidences that the earth is relatively young and doesn't accommodate modern uniformitarian thinking. Simple math shows that there's around 1,650 years from creation to the flood. In the New Testament, Jude 14 verifies that there aren't gaps by calling Enoch the seventh from Adam, which lines up with the Genesis 5 genealogies. Now, we don't know the exact number of years because we know that, for example, Noah did not have Shem on Noah's birthday. Noah wasn't exactly a certain age whenever he had Shem. Otherwise, it would have been on his birthday. And Shem didn't have Arphaxad on Shem's birthday, and so forth. And so there's some rounding of potentially a few months with each of these patriarchs, but assuming the Hebrew text is correct in its transmission, we can be confident that the span of time between creation and the flood was 1,656 years, give or take about 5 years. This is a chart showing the lifespans of each of the 10 patriarchs from Adam to the flood based on the Hebrew text, and so we have about 1,650 years from creation to the flood. Notice that Adam was actually alive to meet all of the patriarchs with the exception of Noah. Methuselah died the year of the flood. The average lifespan, not counting Enoch, who was taken by God, was 912 years, at least just for these patriarchs. So how in the world do we explain that scientifically? Well, it may have been an effect from several factors, perhaps the lingering effects from the tree of life, less genetic degeneration at this point. So the genome would have been created perfectly by God. It was pristine and has since deteriorated significantly. And so there would have likely been much less disease and sickness at that point. And a major factor was likely the nature of the pre-flood world, which Peter described as having perished. The fossil record reveals characteristics of the pre-flood world that proves it to be much different than the earth today. So, for example, not only did people live longer, But living things apparently grew larger, from enormous reptiles to enormous plants, both of which the fossil record reveals. Reptiles and plants grew to be enormous in pre-flood years, and shortly thereafter, the trees of petrified forest out in northeast Arizona are trees thought to be from the pre-flood world that were petrified rapidly due to the flood and then transported to the area that they're found in now. And so notice how large these trees were. I stepped off this particular trunk, some of which is buried, and so I knew it had to be even longer, but it was roughly 105 feet. When you compare that length to the height of a human, you have this. So the distance between my thumb and index finger on this umbrella compared to the entire length of the umbrella. So again, that's just the trunk. That's not even the whole part of the trunk, some of which is buried and some of which was probably lost in transport. A park ranger told me that the longest trunk in the park he knew of is 137 feet. So when you add in the rest of that was likely lost, as well as the branches and leaves, you have evidence of enormous pre-flood trees. Recall also the enormous fruit still growing in Palestine a few centuries after the flood, when two Israelite men had to carry a cluster of grapes on a pole between them. There in Numbers 13:23. The large reptiles of the pre-flood era, of course, were the dinosaurs like this Brachiosaurus that they had on display at the British Natural History Museum. I'm standing down there on the left for scale. Here is a plesiosaur, so a marine reptile. Again, see me for scale on the right. Insects were huge as well. We have fossil evidence of dragonflies with wingspans of over 2 feet, the Meganeura. Also millipedes that were up to 7.5 feet long, the Arthropleura. That's kind of creepy, isn't it? So today we've got a 21% oxygen level in the atmosphere, but there's evidence of much higher oxygen levels in the past, as high as 35% oxygen in the atmosphere. And what's more, besides plants and animals, we know of humans of giant stature having walked the earth and continued to for some time after the flood. We know that after the flood, they could reach at least 6 cubits in a span, what scholars believe to be about 9 feet, 9 inches tall, which was Goliath's approximate height. Before the flood, humans may have even been capable of more height. And I'll talk about that in a later session. Other things we can draw from the text in this period of history, based on the genealogies of Genesis 5, we get a rough idea of how long people lived before the flood. And we find out how much time there was from creation to the flood, roughly 1,650 years. So with that information, we can get a rough estimate of how many people might have been on the earth by the time of the flood, based on certain reasonable conservative assumptions. If we assume people lived 900 years on average, and women continued having children for roughly the first half of their lives as they do today, keeping in mind that they may have been able to have kids much longer, 800 years instead of 450 years. If they started having children at the conservative age of 25 and assume that people lived long enough to see all of their grandkids, so they lived two generations, with those very conservative assumptions in place, we see that there could have easily been 215 million people on the planet at the time of the flood and possibly, probably many more. Some commentators have estimates much higher than that. Moving up to the flood, from the time when men were calling on the name of the Lord early on, when Seth had Enosh, Genesis 4:26, things changed a lot. The reason for the flood given in the text is that every intent or intention, ESV says, of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. The cause of that wicked state on the earth is given in verses 1 and 2 of that chapter. The sons of God, so the good people following God, those who were calling on the name of the Lord contextually, began to notice physical beauty and prioritize that more in their marital decisions. We see that going on today, by the way. The good people began marrying the daughters of men, the more worldly people, based on physical beauty rather than spiritual beauty. Some argue the sons of God were angels who came down and married humans and gave rise to the Nephilim, but Genesis 6:4 indicates that the Nephilim were already around before the sons of God intermarried with the daughters of men. Some say Yeah, but the understanding of the ancients was that the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1 and 2 were the angels. That was the standard belief of the Jews for hundreds of years. But I would say it's also the case that the Jews were mistaken about many things for centuries, from the nature of the Messiah to his kingdom, to, in the case of the Sadducees, the nature of the spiritual realm and the afterlife, which would include the angels. So the beliefs of the ancients isn't a solid argument for accepting one position over another. So bottom line, while it is true that sons of God can mean angels, it does not always mean angels, and context has to determine who's being referred to. Sometimes sons of God merely means the righteous people, as the evidence suggests, I believe, in this passage. The expression sons of God and daughters of men are idioms referring to the good people, so those who were calling on the name of the Lord in Seth's lineage, Genesis 4:26, marrying the bad people, generally assumed to be the descendants of Cain. And so we keep in mind that the original book of Genesis, of course, had no chapter breaks. And so contextually, it would make sense if the sons of God is a reference to those people that were discussed immediately prior to that text. So the ones who were calling on the name of the Lord, Genesis 4 and 26. We also notice from Genesis 6, 11 and 12 that God saw violence filling the earth and that all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Most commentators immediately assume that the phrase all flesh is referring solely to humanity, referring to the moral state of man. But it's also true that all flesh is used to refer to animals at times as well. In fact, even in this very context. So if that is the meaning in Genesis 6 here as well, then it could be referring to a change that had occurred over time in the nature of the animal kingdom as well. Not that they had made a moral change, but that their nature had become corrupted, and they'd become more violent, either due to how humans interacted with them or possibly due to genetic deterioration. We find evidence in the flood layers of violence between creatures, especially the dinosaurs. We find evidence of the T-Rex, for example, chomping on other dinosaurs. We even have the fossilized bite prints and so forth. All right, so if so, then the violence that God saw on the earth also then included the animal kingdom, which was very likely not initially violent, considering again from chapter 1 that God initially created the animals to be herbivore. Notice also the phrase, his days shall be 120 years in Genesis 6:3. I want to take a moment to talk about that. Some people will take this to mean that God was setting a limit as to how long man would be able to live from then on. He's not going to be able to live 900 years. He's going to live 120 years max. That doesn't work to be the interpretation here for a few reasons. Number one, Albert Barnes makes the point that man in this verse is referring to the single entire race of man rather than the plurality of individuals making up the human race. So the 120 years seems to be referring to the life of the race of man as a whole. The whole race is going to die in 120 years. Number two, man continued to live beyond 120 years for centuries after the statement was made. Number three, it would be strange to arbitrarily select 120 as the upper limit for life longevity and deem that to be a punishment on wickedness. And then number four, the point of this whole section is to show how God ultimately punished the world through the flood. And so the punishment being referred to with 120 years would seem to need to be related to that. So it makes more sense contextually to be saying, man is wicked, and I'm not going to put up with it forever. My spirit won't strive with man forever. I'm going to reach a breaking point here. In fact, you've got 120 years to change your mind, so Noah, you better get to work. And so incidentally, when you look closely at the text, you see that Noah was 500 when Shem, Ham, and Japheth were born, and 600 when the flood came. And that's not 120 years. So from that, we gather that the statement by God here in verse 3 was made during the genealogies of Genesis 5, just before this verse. So God apparently made the decision to bring about the flood some 20 years before the birth of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. God instructs Noah to build a boat. 300 by 50 by 30 cubits. According to scholars, that would translate to a football field and a half long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet tall. He's told to make the ark out of this unknown wood called gopher wood, make three levels on that and have rooms for the animals, cover it with pitch so that it doesn't leak, and put a door in the side of it. God tells him to install an opening, not exactly a window as we think about it in Bible class, but according to the underlying Hebrew, an opening probably for light and possibly ventilation that apparently went around the top of the vessel and was a cubit in height. According to Genesis 8:13, a covering or awning of some sort was put over the opening as well, which was left until the end of the torrential rain period of the flood, and then Noah opens the window-like structure to see the state of things. God apparently brought or sent the animals that he wanted on the ark to Noah. Noah didn't have to go hunt these down. Male and female representative of the unclean kinds of animals, according to chapter 7. There was also seven representatives of the clean kinds of animals, whether that's seven individuals or seven pairs is unclear. Again, these are representatives of kinds, not species. So animals from the earth, including birds and creeping things, which would have included various reptiles. Notice also, Noah brings food for his family and the animals. And then after loading up, God himself shuts the door and the fireworks begin, so to speak. And that, of course, brings us right up to the flood. You know, the works of the Lord are great, studied by all who have pleasure in them, was a verse we looked at early on. So the things that God has done, his works are great, and they're worthy of our study and thought, and I believe that the flood is one of those. If we fail, and the world around us has failed to recognize the evidence for the flood around us, and yet the flood is evidence of God's judgment on sin. He's a holy God. He doesn't like sin. And it's a sad thing that the world has forgotten the testimony of that important fact. The Bible tells us only a few details about the flood. It occurred 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. It was global in its extent. It covered everything. The fountains of the deep were broken up, and water came from above. The mountains rose, the valleys sunk, and it lasted essentially a year. That's about it. And that's not really a lot to work with. So when we look up from our Bible and then look at the physical evidence, and we begin to study this great ancient work of the Lord, which was a key event in the history of mankind, and we begin looking for the evidence of that event and trying to understand our observations, we have to reconcile that physical evidence from the earth with what we see happened in Scripture. And so we ask the question, can we learn further about what happened in the flood from the physical evidence? Does the evidence from geology fit with Scripture? Some have argued that the flood couldn't have been global because when we look at the physical realm, the physical evidence, there's just not enough water on the earth, they say. And so they'll look at the earth today and say, hey, if the flood happened, where's all the water that would be required from this? Where's the water that would have been required to cover the entire planet? Where did it go? Is it in the sky? No, again, there's not enough water in the sky to do that, as I mentioned. Is it frozen in the ice caps? No, that wouldn't do it either. Is it within the crust? Well, that's a little more significant. There are an estimated 6 quintillion gallons of water in the earth's crust today. But if all of that water is pumped back onto the surface of the earth, it'd be enough to cover the earth with 600 feet high of water. So 2 football fields into the sky, and that's just water hidden in the crust. But that's pretty still insignificant. That's less than 1,000 feet total. When you consider the height of the great mountains today, many of which are over 25,000 feet high. And so many of those who would consider numbers like these and still want to believe in the Bible will then often reject a worldwide flood and argue the flood must have been a local catastrophe and not a global one. But as we'll see, that argument simply can't be sustained in light of science or Scripture. So the evidence points to a global catastrophe, and so let's study that for a few moments. First of all, I want to start with a depiction of the flood, what modern creation scientists believe happened during the first few hours of the flood. So as I mentioned before, modern creation science theorizes that much of the water in the flood came from the oceans and from below the earth rather than above, which is what was once thought. But keep in mind that it's also incorrect to think of the flood as only involving water and rain. The flood was a major geologic event. The earth was restructured. So the phrase, the fountains of the great deep were broken up, is significant. The great deep referring to the depths of the ocean. So we're talking about the breakup of the ocean floor. Proverbs 3:20 mentions this as well, stating that the depths were broken up. So the flood is a major geologic event. And notice that the text says all the fountains of the great deep are broken up. There's more than just one. And so again, this suggests the breakup of the ocean floor in its entirety. So the order of events mentioned in Genesis 7 is noteworthy. The fountains of the great deep are broken up. That's mentioned first. And then the water from above is mentioned. So what exactly initiated this chain of events is unclear. Did God miraculously, directly initiate the eruption of the fountains of the great deep? Or did he use some external physical entity like a massive meteorite? There is a substantial amount of physical evidence that suggests that a lot of meteorites struck during what we understand to be the flood layers. Secular geologists tell us that there are roughly 200 craters on the earth that have been verified as being from meteorites. When you convert the dates that they give for those craters to the biblical time frame, we find that 57% of the confirmed meteorite impacts throughout Earth history struck during the single year of the flood. Another 23% of the confirmed meteorite impacts date to the period immediately following the flood, from the flood through the Ice Age and up to Abraham. So 80% of all the known meteorite impacts occurred during the flood and during the following few centuries as the earth was calming down. Let me tell you, it took a long time to make that animation. So regardless, creation geologists have tried to piece together what may have occurred after that point based on what we understand about geology today. Geologists have determined that the interior of the earth is comprised of a solid inner core, a liquid outer core, a mantle of predominantly solid rock, although the upper part has some plasticity, and then we have the crust upon which we live. Now, looking at the surface, geologists have discovered that the surface of the earth is broken up into plates that move around relative to one another, today on the order of centimeters per year. And so the earth is kind of like a big cracked egg, and the earth is apparently unique in that. Earth so far is the only known planet to have these plates. And creation geologists believe the cracking of that egg may have occurred at the initiation of the flood. Recent articles by various secular geologists suggest that plate tectonics may have been initiated by meteorite activity. In fact, specifically at the beginning of the Cambrian, which we would say is the flood. So the model that describes the motion of these plates and the effects of that motion is called plate tectonics in geology. And most geologic activity on the earth occurs along the margins of these plates as they move relative to one another. So your earthquake activity, your volcanoes, your mountain building, as these plates move relative to each other, different things happen. So some transform, sliding past one another. Some diverge, so they move apart. And then new material from the mantle comes up into the gap. Some converge with one side subducting under the other. So one plate goes under the other and starts diving in towards the mantle. And so mountains and volcanoes slowly form as this occurs. So mountain building is extremely slow since the plates are moving so slow. It would take eons at today's rates to form these mountains that we have around us. So if mountain forming is happening today at such slow rates, then how can biblical creationists explain that evidence in a short time frame? How can this be harmonized with Scripture? And again, this is why it's important to have a good model. So let's think about plate tectonics and the movement of these plates that comprise the surface of the earth From the movement of these plates, geologists are able to extrapolate backwards to get an idea of the past. Plate tectonic theory is able to explain why the continents fit together like a puzzle, why you have, so I'm sure you all have seen how South America fits into Africa nicely, as do the other continents, but you also have other characteristics this helps with. We've got matching rock layers and mountain belts on different continents that are now separated by oceans, but when you put this together, they fit together, these mountain ranges and these rock layers, even though they're now spread apart. So plate tectonics explains why we have matching fossil distributions across these puzzle pieces when you put it back together that are now separated, and many other things. The magnetic striping on the ocean floor has great explanatory power. But as usual, modern naturalistic theories are based on erroneous assumptions, in this case, once again, uniformitarianism. So the idea that whatever we see going on today in geology, any kind of processes and rates, it's assumed it's always gone on that way. Any kind of rate you see going on today has always been that way. So cataclysmic events, which we can't witness today, we assume they never happened. That's what uniformitarianism would say. So the flood never happened because we can't witness that today. So if the continents are moving apart at centimeters per year today, they must have always done that. And therefore, it must have taken eons for the continents to fit together like this. Well, as we've already seen, the Bible can be known to be inspired. We have positive evidence for that. It is a true account of history. So that means that the flood did occur. You can't assume that it didn't. That means that uniformitarianism is not right. So the effects of global catastrophes in the past have to be considered if they could have played a role in plate movement. Ironically, they're really even moving away from this assumption themselves, because the dominant belief now is a massive meteorite hit down there outside of Mexico that killed off all the dinosaurs and 70% of the species on the planet. That's a global catastrophe and had major ramifications geologically. So even they are backing away from that assumption. The minute you reject uniformitarianism now, that changes everything. We would say catastrophism is a much better model, a much better way of viewing geology. So the effects of any global catastrophes have to be considered. So using the actual evidence from modern geology and plate tectonics, but without the hidden assumption of uniformitarianism, creation geologists have come along and developed our own theory, catastrophic plate tectonics, CPT. A young Earth creation geophysicist by the name of John Baumgartner laid the groundwork for this model when he developed a supercomputer program at UCLA when he was doing doctoral research in geophysics and space physics. The program that is called TERRA helps to model the dynamics of the Earth's interior. And based upon the predictions of that program, other creation physicists and geologists joined him in developing catastrophic plate tectonics that describes what likely happened during the flood. So significantly paraphrasing this model, before the flood, the plates didn't exist and the continents were not separated. At the onset of the flood, the fountains of the great deep were broken up, Genesis 7:11. So the plates broke apart. Understand that the fountains of the deep, that we're not necessarily just talking water here. This would include magma from beneath the earth. So according to CPT, something causes the breakup of the cold, dense ocean floor, breaks it in several places, including breaking the ocean plates away from the continental plates. And according to computer simulations, when that break at the boundaries between the continental plates and the oceanic plates occurred, there would be runaway thermal subduction of the seafloor after that. So instead of the creeping rate at which plates are moving into the mantle today, at this point in the flood, the seafloor is diving into the mantle rapidly. In 1994, when CPT was being developed, creation scientists predicted that if this is right, if this theory is right, then we can make a prediction. The mantle was essentially completely overturned like a conveyor belt quickly. So therefore, there should be evidence of colder material still in the mantle because this only happened a few thousand years ago. There hasn't been enough time for it to totally heat up. So if uniformitarian plate tectonics is true, then the process of plate movement has always gone on extremely slow, And so there would have been plenty of time for any of that material from the ocean floor to heat up before it got very deep in the mantle. So in other words, there shouldn't be enormous piles of cold ocean floor down in the mantle stuck on basically on top of the core. Well, sure enough, 3 years after this prediction in 1994, seismic images of the mantle's density structure verified the creationist prediction and showed that there is evidence of enormous piles of cooler slabs of material in the mantle, specifically under subduction zones. So apparently remnants of the pre-flood ocean crust that piled up on the mantle. So this rapid diving would have caused the plates to be moving rapidly on the order of meters per second rather than today's rates of centimeters per year. So in other words, the supercontinent would have begun to break up and move apart rapidly, and that would have caused the rapid formation of mountains along the subduction zones and convergent zones as materials are piling up as plates dove and slammed into each other. And so you picture a conveyor belt with the cold crust of the ocean floor diving into the mantle, and hot mantle material is now coming up at the under the ocean floor replacing that. So what's going to happen? The extra hot magma hits the cold ocean water and evaporates the water, now sending steam jettisoning into the atmosphere. So that magma would have been coming up along all of the divergent zones all over the Earth, most of which are in the oceans. So this would have caused intense rain around the globe for a period of time as these geysers that stretch for hundreds of miles all over the Earth erupted, pumping water high up into the atmosphere that then comes back down as rain from the heavens onto the land. So the added magma now to the sea floor is also going to have implications to it. You've got this magma on the sea floor. It's going to displace water from the seas onto the land, onto the continents. So that hot material that's replacing the cold material on the ocean floor is less dense because it's hotter and it's lighter. So essentially, the ocean floor is floating higher in the mantle, pushing the sea floor up, creation physicists and geologists believe, 3,500 feet or more. So as the sea floor is raised, water from the seas would have spilled onto the land, carrying with it many sea creatures, which explains why we've got so many marine animals all over the planet, even on dry land and even up on the mountains. And so water is coming in from the ocean and bringing with it sediment and creatures. And so the sea level's rising, and water is then also coming down from these immense geysers. Tsunamis would have been rocking the land due to the major tectonic activity under the ocean. So most of the water from the flood is coming from the oceans through the sea floor pushing water onto the land, and then these geysers. Now, while all of that's going on, we also keep in mind that these meteorite impacts are occurring. Wouldn't you have loved to have been on the Earth while this was going on? I found a simulation of what some secular geologists believe about the land. By the way, I was being sarcastic about that. You do not want to be. The stuff I've learned out in Wyoming studying seismites, you do not want to be on the ground. The dinosaurs are being disintegrated by what's going on. The dinosaur beds I was working in Wyoming, the dinosaurs have been ripped into pieces, like thousands of them, and then carried and then dumped in this area. We're talking, they're not even articulated, where you've got an entire dinosaur, remains that have been, no, they've been torn apart due to the Rockies forming over there on the west, which at that time would have been the west coast. It is just disintegrating life. Anything that's still alive at that point in the flood is just getting destroyed. Anyway, so the configurations and movements that they're depicting, the secular geologists may well be correct, although moving much faster, and much of the land would be underwater in this simulation I'm going to show you while the movement is occurring, especially after 5 months into the flood. So from this simulation, I took all of the known meteorite impacts from the flood and where they struck the Earth and added them to the simulation showing approximately when and where those meteorites would have struck during the flood. And so we have to keep in mind that these are only the craters that have been discovered so far. And obviously, any meteorites that struck the ocean areas during the flood wouldn't leave craters as readily, which is why the verified meteorite craters are generally land craters. So in order to get a better idea of how many meteorites actually struck during the flood, you have to add quite a few more. So far, there are over 100 meteorite craters that have been found on land that correlate to the flood period, but 70% of the surface of the earth is in the ocean. And so if we take what we know about the land and extrapolate to the ocean areas, we have to add around 230 more meteorite impacts during the flood. So you got over 330 meteorites in all, at least, that are slamming the earth. And so clearly meteorites are a significant part of the flood and the creation model that has to be taken into account. So let's look at Psalm 104 here. You covered it, the earth, with the deep, as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. The mountains rose. The valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. In light of verse 9, it seems clear that this passage must be referring to the flood, not the creation week. Otherwise, this passage would be violated during the flood. But assuming this does refer to the flood, then it makes perfect sense. It fits with this model, because the modern creation model would say that the high mountains were formed during the flood, when these plates are smashing into each other at convergence and subduction zones. Due to the formation of the mountains in the flood, it is now impossible for there to be enough water to completely submerge the earth again, just like this passage says. So by the mountains rising and the valley sinking, verse 8, a boundary was set for the water that it might not again cover the earth. It can't happen anymore. We don't have enough water to do it. So the mountains are being formed during the flood. So according to the text, the rain itself continues for 40 uninterrupted days and nights, but that wasn't the extent of the catastrophe. The waters apparently continued to rise for some time after that. According to CPT, that would be due to the fountains of the deep continuing to disperse lava and possibly water from beneath the earth, displacing the seas onto the land. So the rising waters eventually leveled out and apparently began to decrease on the 150th day into the flood. So 5 months from the beginning of the flood, the water was 15 cubits above the mountains, 22 to 23 feet, allowing for the draught of the ark. So notice that during this catastrophic period, typical earth processes, seasons, day and night, and so forth, were totally disrupted. After the flood, God promises in chapter 8, verse 22, that he's not going to allow that to happen on a global scale again. The disruption of the seasons as well as day and night also would be expected under this model. The cloud cover from both water and aerosols from the volcanic activity would have effectively stopped day and night and blocked out sunlight, and with it summer and much of the heat we receive. Obviously, seed time and harvest would be stopped while the earth was covered with water. All right, so let's return to the question we asked at the beginning. How could the flood be global? How could there be enough water to cover the earth prevailing above the mountains over 20 feet? So with the CPT model I've laid out, you can probably already see the answer to this question, and it helps you to see why it's valuable to have a model. So let's look at the science side first. Remember that CPT theory would say that the water came primarily from the seas, both in the form of rain from these enormous geysers and in the form of the sea level being raised from magma and hotter ocean floors. And then we recall from Psalm 104 that the taller mountains are forming during the flood, and we recall from CPT that the mountains are forming as the plates are converging and subducting. And so therefore we realize that the pre-flood world would have been much flatter. So that's an important part of the model. So notice it wouldn't have been nearly as hard to cover the land with water at that point, because the tall mountains wouldn't have been formed until later in the flood, when the recession had already begun. So you picture a flatter earth and one with a lower elevation, and covering the highest points on the earth by day 40 wouldn't require anywhere near the amount of water that it would require today. Okay, so where did the water go after the flood? Well, first of all, the ocean floor was raised during the flood, and the intense geyser activities going on from the fountains of the deep. So that activity would have dumped loads of sediment onto the continents from the ocean, which would raise the level of the continents relative to the pre-flood times. And on top of that, you've got the mountains forming at these various boundaries, which would raise the land in those areas even further, especially over here in the east where you've got the Appalachians, for example. So notice, without the water going anywhere, the continents would have been higher in elevation, making them stick out of the water further than in the pre-flood times. But then you have to consider other implications of CPT. So recall that as the ocean floor is diving into the mantle, new material is coming up and replacing it. That material is hotter, which means it's less dense, which means it's sitting higher in the mantle, which would have raised the ocean floor. Okay, that conveyor belt process would have gradually slowed, and the steam jets would have stopped. And then as that new material on the ocean floor is cooling, it's going to become more dense again. So what's going to happen? It's now going to drop. It's going to sit lower in the mantle, which effectively slowly lowers the seafloor again and creates the valleys. So that would then allow much of the water covering the land to recede back to the ocean from where it came. So bottom line, there's no... So by the way, that means the oceans, that is the water from the flood. That's where you're looking at. So there's no problem from science in explaining where the water for a global flood would have come from and where it went. Other evidences of a global flood from science, starting at the Cambrian explosion in the geologic record. So at the beginning of the Paleozoic layers, the point where creationists believe the flood started, you have worldwide sandstone beds that were laid down by some kind of major catastrophic worldwide water event. I wonder what that would be. And so you can follow these layers across the U.S., then jump over the ocean, and you see the same layers continuing onward into Europe. These aren't localized beds of sediment that you see in the higher layers of the geologic column after the flood. Okay? These are worldwide beds. They begin at the Cambrian explosion, and then similar worldwide beds continue on up in the geologic column to the point at which the flood is thought by many to end, just above the Mesozoic layers. And also sedimentary rock is the dominant rock type throughout those worldwide layers. Sedimentary rock being rock that is generally agreed to be rocks formed from water activity. When we move from science now and look at the Bible, we find that the Bible simply doesn't leave room for a local flood interpretation. Very quickly notice, if it was a local flood, then why in the world would you build an ark over 100 years or so? Why not just leave the area? Why bring animals from all over if this was local? Bringing representatives of every living thing of all flesh, why do that if it's local, since God actually brought the animals to Noah anyway, and why not just bring them out of the area instead? How would the ark be able to stay afloat for several months if this was just a local flood? How could the biblical terminology describing the water as covering the high mountains that were under the whole heaven be describing a local flood? How could water even get high enough locally to cover mountains if the flood wasn't greater in its extent? How could the biblically stated purpose of wiping man from the face of the whole earth be accomplished with a local flood? If the flood was local, then notice God lied when he promised never to destroy the earth again with a flood in the way he did. Local floods occur all the time, but not global floods. Also, Peter used the universal destruction of the earth and the flood to describe what judgment day will be like. So if the flood wasn't universal, then logically judgment won't be either, which doesn't make sense. Also, why would the seasons have been affected if this was just a local flood? Apparently, seed time, harvest, winter, summer, day, and night stopped during the flood. That doesn't sound like the effects of a local flood. A great point by a kid that came to one of our Christian Evidences camp over the summer. Why did the dove find no resting place for the sole of her foot when sent out if this was a local flood? So the Bible simply doesn't leave room for a local flood interpretation. Either the Bible's right that there was a global flood or not, and there's no reason to question the Bible's claim that there was a global flood scientifically. There's so much evidence for it. All right, on the same day the waters began to decrease, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat, and the waters continued to recede for another 4 months. And during that period of recession, we know that the retreating floodwaters would have catastrophically eroded many of Earth's canyons, though not all of those. Grand Canyon comes later. After 9 months, on the first day of the 10th month, Noah could see the tops of various mountains. After another 40 days, he sends out a raven and a dove, and then waits another week, sends the dove out again. After it returned, he waited another week, sent the dove out. The dove did not return. He waited about another month, removed the covering from the ark, seeing that the surface of the earth was dry. And after another almost 2 months, the earth had completely dried, and they leave the ark. So the timeline, as given in the text, is based on the Jewish calendar, which reckons time based on a lunar year, 354 days total. So based on the text, about a year and 11 days passed. And so when the conversion is made from lunar to the solar calendar, you find that from beginning to end, Noah and the other passengers left the ark after one solar year, exactly 365 days. Noah and his family, eight people, exited the ark, and from those eight people, repopulated the entire earth. Genetically, we all have a portion of Noah and a portion of his wife in our blood, regardless of our ethnicity. But whether or not the wives of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth were also part of Noah's family, like sisters or cousins, we don't know. If so, then the portion of our genes that can be traced to Noah grows. But unless all eight survivors were in Noah's family, then it can't be said genetically that all of our blood came directly from Noah and his wife. There could have been some intermarrying with other tribes. So the passengers from the ark, of course, would have found a completely different earth from the one that they experienced before the flood. Peter says that the world that then existed perished, and there is no doubt more meaning to that than we typically ascribe to it. This chart gives the lifespans of the patriarchs as recorded in Genesis 5 and 11. So you'll notice the approximate 900-year lifespan before the flood, with the exception of Enoch and Lamech, and then notice this gradual drop in lifespans after the flood. And so keep in mind that these Genesis 11 genealogies, which pick up after the flood, aren't quite as clear-cut as the Genesis 5 genealogies, and we'll talk about that briefly in a moment. But this seems to provide some evidence for the fact that apparently something was significantly different about the earth after the flood, likely in the environmental change. Apparently size, health, life longevity began to drop drastically in some kind of exponential decay function, possibly in a proportional way to what was going on the earth as it gradually calmed down after the flood. As further evidence of the major change that apparently occurred, Genesis 9, 2, and 3 says that animals would begin to fear and dread humans, possibly indicating something different about the nature of animals. And then in verse 3, apparently linked with this statement about the animals, we have the first mention of God authorizing a carnivorous diet for humans, which would certainly lead to animals fearing humans, I would think. So again, whether or not some humans were already eating meat before this is unclear, but for sure God authorizes it here. It's also unclear as to whether this is the point at which animals formally became carnivorous. Again, this isn't necessarily demanded by the text. The rainbow is used as a sign of God's covenant with the earth to never again destroy the earth with water. We oftentimes might assume that this is the first time the rainbow ever made its appearance on earth, and it's been used as further proof of the vapor canopy theory, which postulates that there was no rain on the earth prior to this point, and so the rainbow would have made its first appearance with the first rain. But again, that's not necessarily demanded by the actual text. In fact, many commentators recognize this and argue that the rainbow was already in existence and that God was just attaching significance to it at this point, and similar to the significance he attached to, for example, the emblems of the Lord's Supper. Even though the apostles were already eating unleavened bread and drinking juice during the meal in which Passover was instituted, significance was placed on those at that point. So if there had already been rain on the earth, then there would have been rainbows with it, since they are an inevitable effect of rain and sunlight based on God's laws of nature. And so that said, even if there had been rainbows before the flood, there wouldn't have been one during the flood, because sunlight is now being completely blocked by the heavy cloud cover and volcanic aerosols in the atmosphere. You got the seasons being hampered. This gives more evidence then for the fact that the reappearance of the rainbow in sunlight, imagine, after an entire year without it, that would have been extremely significant to Noah and his family, and God may have been merely attaching further meaning and symbolism to the rainbow's appearance at this point. So regardless, this is another place where we wouldn't want to be dogmatic, where the text isn't decisive, and this is something we have to be careful about, and reading too much into the text, that can come back to bite you in science. Another example of how different the world was after the flood is the ice age, or the ice surge, or ice advance, depending upon which creation scientist you talk to. We find a lot of evidence on the earth that a large portion of the earth was once covered with ice. In fact, 30% of the land was once covered with ice, as opposed to 10% like it is today. We can observe glacier movement today and see the effects of glaciers. And so from these observations, we infer that the glaciers of the north used to extend down deep into the northern hemisphere. We find parallel striations, so scratches on rocks that extend over miles and miles of plains from rocks and boulders that would have been in glaciers, scratching those rocks under the glaciers as the glaciers move, faceting some rocks, wearing them flat from the glacier movement. You find till and moraines that pile up around the edges of glaciers as they move. Secular geologists today believe that there were multiple ice ages over the last few million years, as many as 50. But there are many issues with the modern interpretation of the evidences for the ice ages. No single theory has been able to explain all of the evidence. Why were all of the animal extinctions only after the last ice age? 167 entire genera of large mammals that are greater than 100 pounds completely disappear from the earth. Why do you have all of the disharmonious associations where you've got warm area animals like hippos mixing with your cold area animals like your woolly mammoths and reindeers? Why do we have evidence of deserts that clearly used to be wet? And of course, the biggest issue that uniformitarians have, there is no known mechanism to initiate a single ice age, much less multiple ice ages. So how would they even get started? Well, this is a place where, once again, creation science has provided a solid answer to these problems. In fact, an ice age would be predicted to follow the flood based on the CPT model I've laid out for you. It would be a necessary effect. Modern creation science theorizes there weren't multiple ice ages. There was a single ice age, and we call it more of an ice advance rather than an ice age because we think of it as a gradual buildup that only lasted about 700 years with a peak at about the 500-year mark. And so creation scientists would say that all of the evidence that secular meteorologists are arguing for ice ages over millions of years actually fits instead into a single major ice age that only lasted a few hundred years. All right, now, what would be needed to begin an ice age? Well, you might be tempted to think, well, you just need colder winters. That'd be enough. Well, that actually would have the opposite effect because with the cold comes dryness, less moisture. And that gets at the root of why secular meteorologists can't figure out how to even begin one with the conditions they believe occurred in the past on Earth. Three basic ingredients are needed: cooler summers, more moisture, and then persistence of those ingredients. All three of these would have been effects of the flood. According to CPT, the volcanic activity during and after the flood would have shot ash and aerosols into the atmosphere, blocking some solar radiation and cooling the summers. That would have caused less melting during the summertime, so the ice would have continued to advance annually each winter in waves, eventually causing more and more extinctions, especially towards the end of this period. The pre-flood environment was also likely warmer, including the ocean, but then the volcanic activity during and after the flood would have then heated the oceans by several more degrees, all right? So what would be the result of that? Much more evaporation of the seawater, which leads to intense snowfall, especially away from the equator, since your sun rays were halted by the aerosols and ash. And then the third ingredient, persistence of these effects. And we predict that the volcanic activity continued for some time after the flood. The oceans would have continued providing significantly elevated evaporation for possibly centuries until the earth calmed down and things moved back towards an equilibrium state, at which time the ice would have begun to retreat. Towards the end of that period, catastrophic melting would be predicted to occur, with huge amounts of water forming lakes, even in deserts. And that explains the wet deserts of the past. As the lakes grew from the melting, then many of the natural dams that are holding the water in these makeshift lakes would breach, causing the rapid formation of canyons, a phenomenon that is accepted even among the secular geologists to have occurred during during an ice age in the past. The Lake Missoula flood is known to have occurred due to the failure of a natural dam during an ice age. And it was caused major canyons. Grand Canyon is believed by creation scientists to have been formed in this manner during the ice advance period. Had the opportunity to travel down through the Grand Canyon by raft with the leading young earth creation geologist on the Grand Canyon to study the Grand Canyon. And basically, again, the layers of the Grand Canyon are believed to have formed during the flood. But then during the Ice Age period, there are evidences on the Colorado Plateau of ancient lakes that probably breached and rapidly carved the Grand Canyon during the Ice Age period after the flood. So the creationist ice advance theory may or may not be true. Again, it's just a theory. But it has explanatory power where modern uniformitarian models fail to explain the evidence. So it explains why we have a huge number of animal extinctions that only occurred once, because there's only one ice age. It explains the disharmonious associations of the animals, because you've got milder winters and cooler summers that keeps the animals relatively mixed. It explains the evidence for wet deserts. The rapid formation of the post-flood canyons is explained. The thickness of the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica are explained. And of course, the biggest plus is that a clear-cut trigger is given for initiating the ice advance, and that is predicted by the flood. All right, we're wrapping it up here now. Keep in mind, while all of this is going on, we have humanity reproducing after the flood. Genesis 10 and 11 give genealogical information about those intervening centuries during what creation scientists theorize to be the ice advance. And so it helps us to see which line from Noah repopulated which areas of the world. Not much beyond that is known. Some argue that the mention of Peleg and the genealogies, a word which means divide, that coupled with the statement that the earth was divided in his days. Some believe that refers to the breakup of Pangaea and plate tectonics. But again, that's already going on during the flood. Contextually, when you remove the chapter divisions that wouldn't have existed when Moses wrote down this book, it makes more sense that Peleg's name is a reference to the division that took place when God divided the earth by language at the Tower of Babel. So again, not much is explicitly stated about the period immediately after the flood. There's not really evidence of writing at all for some time. The Bible gives us genealogies for this period. From Seth to Abram, there are 10 generations. Some again argue maybe there's gaps in these genealogies that we can squeeze some time in, that maybe even if we couldn't do that in Genesis 5. And as evidence, they point to Luke 3:36, where Canaan is added to the genealogies as the son of Arphaxad. And it is true that the Hebrews didn't have a word for grandfather or grandson. They just had the word son. And so when referring to a grandson, they would sometimes say son's son, but sometimes they wouldn't. And so you have to be careful, because sometimes they would say son, but mean grand or great grand and so forth. So son can be more like a descendant. And that's the basis of this argument with Canaan, that he was one of the descendants between Arphaxad and Salah. But in this case, a careful analysis of the evidence indicates Canaan was likely added as a scribal error sometime after Luke wrote this book. So there's no solid evidence that the genealogies of Genesis 11 have gaps. And there's no need for there to be gaps, because the evidence from science and archaeology harmonize with a short span of time between the flood and Abraham. And keep in mind, even if you squeeze time in here, it's still not really helping with the geology issue. Humans are already on the scene at this point. So that said, while there is no evidence of gaps in the lineup, Moses' terminology in Genesis 11 isn't the same as that of chapter 5 when you compare that. And when all of the evidence is weighed, there is potentially room for a few hundred years in Genesis 11 genealogies, but not thousands, much less millions. We've got some articles on our website on that. But keep this in mind. When you stand back and look at the question of time and the genealogies, even if there were gaps in Genesis 11 that amounted to millions of years, or even if the ambiguity of Genesis 11 that I was just talking about allowed for millions of years, it still is not causing the creation model to fit the evolutionary paradigm. Because again, when you look at the actual fossil record as portrayed by the evolutionists, guess where the humans are showing up? The genus Homo, when we look at the actual fossil record, it shows up at the very top, roughly 2 million years ago based on evolutionary timescales. Well, Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 are both genealogies of humans. So squeezing time into those genealogies only helps at the very top of the fossil record, which isn't where evolution and deep time geology needs its time. So anyway, the implication scientifically of this is that you can't nail down precisely where the flood was or the creation because of the ancient way of thinking in this matter, but you can get basically kind of outside bars of where it would be. So the flood could have been anywhere between 2350 BC and a few centuries before that, and the creation could be 6,000 years ago or a few centuries beyond, which is why we generally say that the creation was 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, so we put some fudge room in there. Moving forward, you have Babel, which could have easily been as early as 100 years after the flood or a few decades later, and this would fall during the period of the Ice Age, according to CPT, which might, notice, help explain humanity's reluctance to obey God and spread out beyond the Palestinian area, and why God chose to step in when he did to make sure that the spread happened before the conditions of the Ice Age prevented or removed passage in certain cases to different areas. So regardless, we know, at least at this point after the flood, only one language is still spoken for at least these few hundred years between Babel and, or between the flood and Babel, a few decades really. And then language divisions are officially created, at least in the post-flood world for the first time. And the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth then spread out from Palestine. Archaeologists divide what they call early human history into three ages: the Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age. The Stone Age would correlate to what we would call post-flood and pre-Abraham, the Bronze Age roughly to Abraham to David, and then the Iron Age from David to us. So we would correlate the Stone Age with the post-flood period, especially the period of the dispersion after Babel. So archaeologists looking at the artifacts that have been dug up in early post-flood sediment, they see evidence that humans were nomadic during that time, and they call them hunter-gatherers moving from place to place. They believe they were doing that for thousands of years, of course, until they evolved to the point where they began to settle and farm. We, of course, would interpret the same evidence differently. First of all, the dating techniques they're using have erroneous assumptions, which we'll talk about in another session. Humans were only primarily nomadic for a few hundred years. But yes, we would agree that with the evidence that humans were nomadic during that period. Why? Because after Babel, they're spreading out as God told them to. They were nomads. They were following herds of animals, possibly even providentially guided by God, these animals, so that people would populate the areas that God wanted them to populate. Humans followed those herds for food. So it wasn't that they weren't intelligent enough to farm or hadn't evolved enough yet. It's that they were spreading out and filling the earth. So during that period, as they were traveling, we would expect evidences of simple tools and weapons that are easy to carry, since humans had to carry their possessions from place to place, and since they didn't have a lot of time to stay put and design fancier tools and possessions. So their weapons and tools had to be light and simple to transport. We wouldn't expect evidences of larger weapons or heavy armor. But after a few hundred years, when they were spread out and began to get settled, you'd expect different types of archaeological artifacts to begin surfacing as more products are being developed by humans that would be useful in a farming culture and in a culture that stays put, what archaeologists call the Bronze Age. So it's during that time that we start finding evidence of writing. Could humans write before that, during the dispersion period? Well, possibly. We would expect that they were certainly intellectually capable of that, but there simply may not have been a need for it until they began settling, and therefore building settlements with governments that needed to communicate with other settlements or communicate with the growing number of people within a single community, or possibly had time to begin writing down their histories. It's also possible that though God created multiple languages at Babel, he may not have simultaneously given them the ability to write those languages. So perhaps humans had to develop their own written languages, which could explain any delay in time from the first artifacts and when we find evidence of actual writing. One final point that's important for creation scientists to consider is that we've got all kinds of other localized catastrophic events that the Bible talks about that could be important in understanding the evidence. Major things that God was involved in, from earthquakes and fire and brimstone type stuff going down at Sodom and Gomorrah. And in fact, I would argue the Bible doesn't tell us necessarily everything that God ever did with regard to the civilizations of man. It tells us a certain story of how we get from Genesis 3:6 to the cross. That's the point of it. So everything that is told has something to do with that. That's not to say that there aren't other things that God is doing in other places that could have relevance. There could have been other catastrophic-like things going on, wiping out of other civilizations at other points that have to be kept in mind as creationists. So as we wrap up, consider once again the flood. Jesus called the attention of his audience back to the flood in Matthew 24. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. You know, it's important to study the works of the Lord like the flood. It is crucial that humanity doesn't forget the significance of the flood. The flood is a physical depiction of how God feels about sin. The flood is a reminder about God's holiness and the necessity of human repentance in order to be pleasing to God. It's a reminder that judgment can always be just around the corner when you least expect it. But it's also, notice, a reminder that those who, like Noah, obey God can be saved through water and receive the benefits of God's grace. Once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, 8 souls, were saved through water, there's also an antitype which now saves us, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I think it's interesting that the Bible uses the flood in such a symbolic way to depict the judgment of God, and at the same time, you get to see the grace of God to all those that will choose to submit to his will. Be aware we have 2 vacation Bible schools that are available. Also be aware that we have a Bible class curriculum. It's free and available online. You just need an account to be able to do it. It's for ages 2 through grade 4. Takes kids all the way through the Bible 2 times in 8 years. And then they use our Explorer series after that, 2 years of material for 5th and 6th grade. That is not free because we have to print that. But the rest of this is available as an online curriculum. And we've got activities and coloring sheets, all kinds of things. Advanced Bible Reader, also free for kids. This is a way to encourage kids to do their Bible reading. And then they take little quizzes to see if they've mastered the material. They gain points for that. Eventually, they can get certificates based on however many points they get. Something that's a good thing to do in Bible classes or even as a congregation with the kids to encourage them to read the Bible. So we got tests for the whole Bible, tons and tons of tests for the whole Bible, as well as tests for Christian evidences like materials that we produce at AP. And one other item, make sure you're aware, we have a Christian Evidences Camp for teens each summer that we do to get young people bolstered as they have to face the brunt of the naturalistic push in the school system. So I encourage you to remember that. Okay, isn't the creation model cool? I mean, the flood, it's scary, but it's also pretty neat to study. I mean, there's so much evidence of this. Let me tell you, if you go out in the Appalachians and you understood how the Appalachians formed in the flood, it'll make you look at that totally differently. I don't have time to talk about it now. Ask me about it at lunch or something. I'll tell you about it. It's pretty neat. All right, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Brother Jeff. Those items that, sometimes we...